You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
The French Revolution set Europe ablaze. It was an age of enlightenment and progress, but also of tyranny and oppression. It was an age of glory and an age of tragedy. One man stood above it all. This was the age of Napoleon. I'm Everett Rummage, host of the Age of Napoleon podcast. Join me as I examine the life and times of one of the most fascinating and enigmatic characters in modern history. Look for The Age of Napoleon wherever you find your podcasts.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to episode number 30 of our Civil War podcast. I'm Rich.
And I'm Tracy. Hello, y'all. Welcome to the podcast. It's good to be back with y'all.
It is. And it seems like it's been a while since we've sat down to record an episode, but it's actually just been 2 weeks. In that time, though, we had a great visit to the Gettysburg Battlefield. You would agree, yes?
Yes.
And we were thinking of all you guys while we were at Gettysburg. Some of you have probably already discovered that we shared some photos on the webpage. And we put up some photos and even a short video at the Facebook page. But we thought we'd take a minute or two here at the beginning of this show to each share our favorite experience from our visit to Gettysburg. So, ladies first.
Thank you. Well, as we were at the seminary, I kept thinking about the first-person account of a 15-year-old girl named Tilly Pierce who lived in Gettysburg. This has to do with the Confederates' first brief visit to Gettysburg on June 26th, and not the battle itself, but it's still stuck in my mind. Tilly wrote, quote, "We were having our literary exercises on Friday afternoon at our seminary when the cry reached our ears. Rushing to the door and standing on the front portico, we beheld in the direction of the theological seminary a dark, dense mass moving toward town. Our teacher, Mrs. Eister, at once said, 'Children, run home as quickly as you can.' It did not require repeating. I am satisfied some of the girls did not reach their homes before the rebels were in the streets. As for myself, I had scarcely reached the front door when, on looking up the street, I saw some men on horseback. I scrambled in, slammed shut the door, and hastening to the sitting room, peeped out between the shutters." End quote. And then she goes on writing about what it was like as the Confederate infantry ransacked the town. Anyway, as we were there at Gettysburg, I kept thinking about how, as a woman, I would have felt as the town was invaded and taken over, and what I would have done as the fighting during the battle was going on. And then, of course, there was poor Jenny Wade, and we saw her sister's house on Baltimore Street, where she was killed. She was just 20 years old. I know Rich thought a lot about the men who fought at Gettysburg, and about how he would have acted had he been there fighting. But as a woman, I just thought a lot about the people in town and what, as a woman, I would have experienced during the battle.
Well, that's excellent. And I think that's one reason it's great we're both doing the podcast, because honestly, something like that would never have entered my mind. Well, my favorite experience was definitely on our second day there when we walked Pickett's Charge. We started over at the Virginia Memorial on Seminary Ridge, and we walked out into the fields eastward and crossed the Emmitsburg Road, and then made our way up to the angle in the stone wall and the Union line on Cemetery Ridge. And I'd been to Gettysburg before, but never done that walk, and had always wanted to. And it ended up being everything I'd imagined it would be. A very powerful and emotional experience. That day, Tracy and I had been talking as we walked along through the fields, but by the time we were approaching the angle, I started to get pretty choked up and couldn't really, I just got very quiet as we walked up to the stone wall. And I was thinking about the Union soldiers, guys from Pennsylvania like me, defending that wall. And I thought about the Union cannon up until the very last moment, blasting the advancing Confederates with double loads of canister. And I thought of how the Confederate advance stalled there right before the wall. and then how Armistead led that last courageous surge and the hand-to-hand combat that took place there. So it was really quite an amazing experience to do that walk and then to be standing there on that hallowed ground. Just pretty amazing.
I think we both came back home wanting to jump right into the Battle of Gettysburg here on the podcast, but we decided we'd stick with the timeline and we'll get to everything in its time.
Exactly. And right now, it's time to talk about Fort Sumter. So... on November 21st, 1860, Major Robert Anderson arrived by rail in Charleston, South Carolina. As the new commander of the federal forts located around Charleston Harbor, the 55-year-old Anderson realized that his new job was going to be a very challenging assignment. That's because the election of Abraham Lincoln was barely over, and already secession fever was starting to build across the Deep South. And nowhere did that fever burn hotter than in South Carolina. In fact, before leaving Washington, D.C. for his new posting, Anderson had been warned that South Carolina was all but certain to secede from the Union in the very near future. And if that happened, then the forts in Charleston Harbor would likely become flashpoints where any confrontation might lead to fighting.
With the sense of impending national calamity hanging in the air, Major Anderson had been handpicked to assume command of the Charleston forts by lame duck President James Buchanan's Secretary of War, John B. Floyd. Floyd, a native of Virginia, where he had once been governor, as had his father before him, was sympathetic to the secessionist. Floyd knew that Anderson, a well-respected army officer, was a Kentuckian, and until very recently had been a slave owner. The Secretary of War no doubt expected that in naming Anderson, a Southerner, to command at Charleston, he was appointing an officer who would exercise discretion in avoiding any confrontation that might lead to fighting with the secessionists.
But if Floyd thought the new commander of the Charleston forts would simply roll over to the secessionists when disunion became a reality, then the Secretary of War had seriously misjudged Robert Anderson. Anderson might hail from a slave state, but he was a career regular army officer, and duty and loyalty to the United States ran in his blood. No fewer than 8 of his relations had fought in the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War, and his father had been wounded at Trenton and also at Savannah, Georgia, where he was taken prisoner by the British.
Robert Anderson was born near Louisville, Kentucky in 1805. He graduated from West Point in 1825, 15th in a class of 37, and was commissioned a lieutenant of artillery. Anderson fought in the Black Hawk War of 1832, where he mustered into the service an Illinois militia recruit named Abraham Lincoln, whom he probably never actually met. While serving on the frontier, Anderson won brevet promotion to captain, and he also became quite close friends with another young army officer, Jefferson Davis of Mississippi. During the Black Hawk War, Anderson came across an Indian woman lying dead next to a baby, itself wounded by a musket ball. Anderson rushed the child to a dressing station where its life was saved. 3 days later, he wrote to his brother saying he had witnessed, quote, "misery exceeding any I ever expected to see in our happy land. Dead bodies, males and females, strewed along the road, left unburied, exposed, poor, emaciated beings," end quote.
Then in Florida, Anderson earned praise during the fighting against the Seminole Indians from 1836 to 1838. But while chasing the Seminoles through the swamps of Florida, Anderson also developed recurring fevers and chills, which plagued him for the rest of his life. As both sides committed atrocities in this unfortunate conflict, Anderson found he disliked his second taste of war just as much as he had his first. Robert Anderson's third war came in Mexico. There he served as an artillery officer, and during the siege of Veracruz in 1847, he wrote a letter home in which he admitted, quote, "It really goes to my heart to be compelled to do my duty when I know that every shot either injures or seriously distresses the poor, inoffensive women and children who have neither part nor lot in this war," end quote. Despite those sentiments, Anderson served with distinction during the war with Mexico. He personally led an assault at the Battle of Molino del Rey, where in one of the war's hottest actions, he was wounded several times. His valor on that occasion led to his second brevet promotion to major. But Anderson's wounds, coupled with dysentery and those recurring fevers, all took a toll on him, and his health was never again quite the same.
And just as a footnote, but before his service in Mexico, Anderson had served as an artillery instructor at West Point, where he chose a bright young student from Louisiana named Pierre Gustave Toutant Beauregard to assist his teaching. In April 1861, Beauregard, of course, will be in command of the Confederate forces at Charleston that bombard Fort Sumter into submission.
And just as another footnote, but throughout his years in the Army, before 1860, Robert Anderson served off and on with General Winfield Scott, and the two men grew very close, developing almost a father-son relationship. In fact, when Anderson was notified of his appointment to command the forts at Charleston, the first thing he did was to call on his friend-slash-mentor Winfield Scott at the General-in-Chief's office in New York City to get Scott's advice on his new posting.
To round out this thumbnail sketch of Anderson's life, we should probably mention that in 1845, after remaining a bachelor for years, Robert Anderson married a Southern belle named Elizabeth Bayard Clinch, a member of a prosperous Georgia plantation family. Through his marriage, Anderson came into possession of a number of slaves. Exactly when the Andersons sold their slaves is a bit unclear. Early in 1860 seems likely, but it seems certain that neither Robert nor his wife owned any slaves by the time he took command at Charleston. And then we'll mention that by November 1860, when Robert left to take command of the forts at Charleston, the Andersons had four children, three daughters, Eliza, Sophie, and Marie, and a son, Robert Jr.
By 1860, Robert Anderson had settled into the quiet life of an obscure army officer, and he no doubt was glad that he had put war behind him. Years earlier, while in Mexico, he had written to his wife, saying, quote, "This will, I hope, be the last war I shall take an active part in. I think after the declaration of peace, I may safely promise that I will go a-soldiering no more. I think that no more absurd scheme could be invented for settling national difficulties than the one we are engaged in, killing each other to find out who is in the right." End quote. And so it's one of the great, sad ironies of our country's history that Major Robert Anderson, a soldier who hated war, would, in April 1861, find himself in the very spot where the first shots of the most destructive and bloody war in America's history would be fired.
When Anderson arrived in Charleston in November 1860, he went to Fort Moultrie, which was the only one of the four federal forts there to have a sizable garrison, although sizable here is a relative term, since Moultrie was occupied by just two understrength artillery companies, Companies E and H of the 1st Artillery Regiment, comprising a little over 80 officers, soldiers, and even a few musicians from the regimental band. Of the four federal forts at Charleston, Tiny Castle Pinckney lay nearest to the city itself. It was located on a small island, really just a glorified sandbar, in the shadow of the city's waterfront at the mouth of the Cooper River. Pinckney appeared formidable, but in reality was an obsolete 18th-century structure, and it was occupied only by a single ordnance sergeant and his family.
From Charleston, barely visible out on the horizon, where the approach to the harbor was framed by two islands, there were two more forts. Moultrie, already mentioned, was to the north side of the 1.5-mile-wide entrance on Sullivan's Island. Then to the south was Morris Island, and there a long rocky promontory known as Cummings Point thrust out into the entrance to the bay. Just to the west of Morris Island was James Island, and it was there that Fort Johnson was located. Situated on the northern tip of James Island, Fort Johnson had little strategic value and was vulnerable to attack by land, and like Castle Pinckney, it was occupied only by a single ordnance sergeant.
Last but not least, there was Fort Sumter. Construction of Fort Sumter started in 1829. Located out in the middle of the harbor on a 2.5-acre man-made island of granite rubble beside the main ship channel, about 3 miles from Charleston's waterfront, construction of Sumter was nearly complete in late 1860. a five-sided brick structure meant to defend the harbor from attack by sea, Sumter's walls were 60 feet high and 8 to 12 feet thick. It was designed to hold a garrison of 650 men and to mount 135 guns. When completed, the imposing structure was meant to be the centerpiece of Charleston's harbor's defenses. But because the fort was still a work in progress, when Anderson arrived on the scene, Sumter was occupied only by an engineer officer and 110 civilian workmen.
As we mentioned just a moment ago, Fort Moultrie housed most of Anderson's small command, the 84 or so men of those two companies of the 1st Artillery Regiment. Moultrie was located on Sullivan's Island, on the northern side of the harbor entrance, and besides the fort, there were quite a few seasonal vacation homes and even a hotel located on Sullivan's Island. The island was also a favorite summer picnicking destination for Charleston residents who would row or sail out to the island, hoping the sea breezes would provide some relief from the city's unbearable heat and humidity. When Major Anderson arrived on the scene, to his experienced eye, Fort Moultrie looked exceedingly vulnerable. The ramparts were 12 feet high, but they were also full of cracks that assaulting soldiers could use as handholds and footholds to scale the walls. And then on two sides of the fort, the action of wind and waves had heaped up sand dunes that actually loomed higher than the fort's walls. And so Anderson, in his mind's eye, could easily envision enemy sharpshooters taking up positions on the dunes and firing down into the fort. After surveying the handful of fortifications that made up his new command, and taking into account the imminent secession of South Carolina, Robert Anderson realized immediately that his greatest and most pressing need was for more men. On November 23rd, 2 days after his arrival at Charleston, Anderson submitted his first report to Washington. In it, he warned, quote, Fort Sumter and Castle Pinckney must be garrisoned immediately if the government determines to keep command of this harbor. Castle Pinckney, being so near to the city, they regard as already in their possession. The clouds are threatening, and the storm may break upon us at any moment. End quote.
Anderson must have known very well that reinforcement of his tiny command would be difficult, since the entire peacetime strength of the U.S. Army was only about 16,000 men, and most of that number were stationed out on the western frontier due to the Indian threat. And when he had talked to General Scott, Scott had informed him there were only five companies of regulars even remotely within reach of Charleston. Nevertheless, 5 days after his first report, Anderson renewed his request for reinforcements. Anderson also communicated his unhappiness at finding Moultrie was the main fort, since it was obviously terribly vulnerable to attack by land if secessionists moved to occupy the rest of Sullivan's Island. Sitting in Fort Moultrie, in closing his report, Anderson said, quote, I am inclined to think that if I had been here before the commencement of expenditures on this work, and supposed that this garrison would not be increased, I should have advised its removal to Fort Sumter, which so perfectly commands the harbor and this fort. End quote.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
In all human history, there are few stories like that of ancient Egypt. On the banks of the Nile, these people created one of the most enduring and significant cultures. Their tale comes to life in the History of Egypt podcast, Every week, we explore the tales of this amazing culture, from the legendary days of creation and the gods, all the way to Cleopatra, and everything in between. The History of Egypt podcast is written and produced by a trained Egyptologist. We go much deeper than your average documentary or magazine article to uncover tales of life, great endeavors, and the amazing arc of a mighty kingdom. The History of Egypt podcast is available on all podcasting platforms, apps, and websites. Come, visit ancient Egypt and experience a legendary culture.
Back on November 5, 1860, South Carolina's governor, William H. Gist, had called the state legislature into special session, ostensibly to choose electors, but actually to arrange for the calling of a secession convention should the Republican candidate, Abraham Lincoln, win the upcoming presidential election. And then once that election had passed and Lincoln was known to be the victor, Governor Gist declared, quote, "The election to the presidency of a sectional candidate by a party committed to the support of measures which, if carried out, will inevitably destroy our equality in the Union, the only alternative left, in my judgment, is the secession of South Carolina from the Union." End quote. On November 9th, the bill calling for a secession convention was quickly passed by both houses of the state legislature. The bill specified that delegates to the convention were to be elected on December 6th, and the meeting itself was to take place on December 17th.
Not since the nullification crisis 30 years earlier and the state's battle of wills with President Andrew Jackson had such excitement gripped South Carolina. South Carolina's two U.S. senators, James Hammond and James Chestnut, promptly resigned their seats. The state's members of the House of Representatives were expected to soon follow suit. Abraham Lincoln's election seemed to have thrown open the floodgates of an old, simmering tension, and the entire state of South Carolina seemed to be swept up by an irresistible wave of secession fever. It was this roiling flood of emotion and excitement among the local populace that Major Anderson found upon his arrival in Charleston on November 21, 1860.
As we've already talked about on the podcast, when James Buchanan's annual message was delivered to Congress on December 3rd, the lame duck president offered his opinion that secession was unconstitutional, but that he had no power to coerce any seceding state to remain in the Union. And since you'll hear about coercion quite a bit in the near future, we should probably take a second to explain what it means. Basically, secessionists believed that any state had a constitutional right to leave the Union, and therefore secession was not rebellion, and therefore the federal government had no right to use armed force to coerce or compel a seceding state to stay in the Union. After the fall of Fort Sumter, it's actually the bitter dispute over coercion and Abraham Lincoln's call for states' militia to suppress the rebellion that will ultimately lead to a second wave of secession. That'll be when Virginia, Arkansas, Tennessee, and North Carolina leave the Union. But that's still a ways down the road, so...
Not surprisingly, President Buchanan's annual message and his passive assurance of inaction did nothing to stem secession fever. And as we've discussed previously on the podcast, on December 20th, 1860, the delegates to South Carolina's secession convention voted 169-0 to take the state out of the Union. The South Carolina convention also urged the other slave states to secede and called for the formation of a Southern Confederacy.
In Washington, Buchanan dithered, veering from determination to reinforce Anderson to a policy of standing pat and doing nothing. In his defense, the pressure from all sides was immense. Southern members of Congress and messengers from South Carolina reminded the president that he had no right to coerce any seceding state back into the Union, and any use of armed force would likely lead to the outbreak of a shooting war. At the same time, there were rumblings in the North that Buchanan's inactivity in the face of rebellion ought to lead to his impeachment. Meanwhile, Buchanan's cabinet was breaking up around him, as its northern and southern members glared spitefully at one another, gave the lame duck president conflicting advice, and grumpily handed in resignations. Secretary of War Floyd, being something of a treasonous ass...
Rich.
Sorry. Secretary of War Floyd, despite already being dogged by charges of corruption, hung on to his appointment long enough to add treason to his list of official sins, using his office to expedite private arms shipments to the South, and also to issue orders that federal arms were to be shipped to Southern armories, where they could then be conveniently appropriated by seceding states. And he also strenuously opposed General-in-Chief Winfield Scott's advice that Buchanan reinforce Anderson.
Meanwhile, in South Carolina, the tenure of William Gist came to an end, and the state legislature chose Francis W. Pickens as the new governor. After December 20th, once South Carolina's secession was a done deal, Governor Pickens considered himself to be the chief executive of an independent, sovereign state. And in that capacity, he demanded that all federal property within South Carolina, including the forts in Charleston Harbor, be turned over to the control of the new independent sovereign state of which he was the chief executive.
In his book, Days of Defiance, Maury Klein says, quote, "For Pickens, the new office was an improbable climax to an erratic career. Living up to the reputation of his ancestors had always been for him something of a challenge in which his ambitions seemed to outstrip his achievements. Three generations of prominence had endowed him with the obligatory social polish, classical education, and gift for oratory. Through inheritance and shrewd investments, he had acquired plantations in the Edgefield District of South Carolina and in Mississippi and Alabama. Pickens relished his role among the elite. He exuded the peculiar planter's brew of generosity, charm, and culture mixed with arrogance, pride, imperiousness, and a moody disposition. In a world of aloof, egocentric men, he stood out for his cold, overbearing manner. His gift for rhetoric could fire a crowd, but his personality lacked the warmth to draw men to him." End quote. Pickens' selection as governor of South Carolina was the culmination of a series of clever political moves on his part. He took office on December 17, 1860, just in time to assume center stage in South Carolina's dramatic departure from the Union.
On the same day that South Carolina seceded from the Union, a letter from Governor Pickens was handed to President Buchanan. In the letter, Pickens said he wanted all work on the Charleston fort stopped, no reinforcements sent to them, and approval for state troops to occupy Fort Sumter. For good measure, Pickens also demanded a reply be given within 24 hours. But when other Southerners in Washington, including Jefferson Davis, learned of Pickens' letter to the president and its contents, they deemed it not only unnecessarily provocative, but also embarrassing. A flurry of telegrams between Washington and South Carolina resulted in Pickens being convinced to withdraw his letter. Buchanan, anxious not to rock the boat, decided not to press the issue.
But Buchanan did call in Floyd, that treasonous...
Rich!
Okay. Buchanan did call in Floyd and asked the Secretary of War just what orders Anderson had been given. Floyd told the president that an emissary from the War Department, Major Don Carlos Buell, had recently traveled to Charleston and given Anderson verbal instructions to avoid any act that might provoke the secessionists and to make no hostile move. According to a memorandum summarizing his visit to Charleston, Buell, almost as an afterthought, acknowledged Anderson had too few men to hold all the forts, and so Anderson had been authorized to concentrate his men in any one of the forts.
Since all of South Carolina's representatives and senators had quit Congress, there was no one in Washington to represent the state, so the secession convention decided to send three commissioners to negotiate for the surrender of the forts. Hard on the heels of Pickens' ham-fisted correspondence to Buchanan, these three men, James L. Orr, Robert W. Barnwell, and James H. Adams, arrived in Washington. Buchanan refused to see them in any official capacity, insisting that only Congress could deal with commissioners or make any change in relations with the state. But Republicans in Congress ensured that no one on Capitol Hill would receive the commissioners in any official capacity, since such a reception would legitimize the state's act of secession. And so the end result was that no one in Washington found much joy in the Christmas season.
On the day South Carolina passed its ordinance of secession, December 20th, Major Anderson was just completing his first month of duty as commander of the Charleston forts. To say that it had been an extremely stressful and frustrating month would be an understatement. Almost from the day he arrived, he had implored the War Department to send reinforcements or to issue him specific orders. As early as December 1st, Anderson had declared, quote, "The question for the government to decide, and the sooner it is done the better, is whether, when South Carolina secedes, these forts are to be surrendered or not," end quote. If the forts were to be turned over to South Carolina, then Anderson wanted explicit orders as to how and when that surrender should be carried out. But if the installations were to be defended, then he needed more troops and supplies as soon as they could be sent to him.
Unbelievably, Anderson received no clear direction from his superiors. In Days of Defiance, Maury Klein explains Anderson's predicament. Quote, "If attacked, he was to defend himself, but no reinforcements would be sent because they might increase already inflamed feelings and trigger the attack no one wanted. Meanwhile, all around him, the locals were arming, organizing, drilling, boasting loudly about how the forts would be theirs once the state seceded. Anderson went into the city to see the mayor and some other prominent citizens and received the same message from all of them. They would do everything to prevent any assault by a mob, but one way or another, the forts would be theirs after secession." End quote.
And then Major Buell's visit to Charleston was precious little help for Anderson. Buell had orders from Floyd to give Anderson vague and unsatisfactory instructions that could in no way be construed as actual orders. But Buell decided on his own initiative to tell the hapless commander on the spot that if he, Buell, were in Anderson's shoes, he wouldn't pass up the opportunity to move out to Fort Sumter.
With no explicit orders from the War Department, Anderson agonized over the impossibility of his situation. The bottom line was that with so few troops, there was no way Fort Moultrie could be defended from a determined assault, even one made by half-trained state militia. Anderson knew that the secessionists were determined to occupy Fort Sumter, since it was obvious to everyone that that installation was the key to the harbor's defenses. In fact, on the night of South Carolina's secession, Anderson received word that steamers loaded with armed men had started to patrol the stretch of water between Moultrie and Sumter to prevent Anderson from moving any men out to the latter fort.
Robert Anderson loathed the thought that a shooting war might break out in Charleston on his watch. His goal was to avoid bloodshed, and so to that end, he eventually made a momentous decision. With no clear orders coming from Washington, Anderson made the most important decision of his career, the choice that he thought was ultimately the best way to avoid confrontation. Under cover of night, he would abandon vulnerable Fort Moultrie and move his command out to Fort Sumter. Once he was established in Sumter, out in the middle of the harbor, the hot-headed secessionists couldn't easily get at him, and therefore they couldn't start the war that Anderson was so desperate to avoid.
On December 26th, Anderson informed his officers that he intended to evacuate Moultrie immediately and transfer the garrison out to Fort Sumter. So that word wouldn't leak out to the locals, Anderson waited until the last minute to inform most of his officers of the move. Preparations for the transfer were therefore hurried, and some men had no chance to gather up their personal belongings. Nevertheless, shortly after dusk, the first boats were pushed out into the harbor. About halfway across to Sumter, there was a tense moment when a steamer drew near, but it was just a ship towing a vessel out to the bar, and it passed by, not suspecting that anything out of the ordinary was taking place. As luck would have it, the patrol steamer was late leaving the dock the evening of the 26th, and by the time it settled in for its belated circuit of the harbor, it unknowingly no longer had anything to guard, since the transfer to Sumter had already been successfully carried out.
Turning once more to Maury Klein, he writes, quote, "There would be hell to pay when Charleston awoke to the news. Anderson was sure of that. But he was even more certain that he had done the right thing, the only thing, to avert disaster." On that first night in Sumter, Anderson composed a report to the adjutant general. "I have the honor to report," he began, "that I have just completed, by the blessing of God, the removal to this fort of all of my garrison. The step which I have taken was, in my opinion, necessary to prevent the effusion of blood." the message would not reach Washington until December 29th. He did not pretend to know how long he and his men would be holed up on their Granite Island. What he did know, and took considerable pride in, was that he had bought time for the politicians. The question was what, if anything, they would do with it. End quote.
That means it's time for our book recommendation, and our recommendation this time is the book we've referenced several times in this episode. It's Days of Defiance, Sumter, Secession, and the Coming of the Civil War by Mari Klein.
And really, all I can think to say about Days of Defiance is that it's not only one of the best Civil War books we've ever read, it's one of the best history books we've ever read, period. So if it's not already on your bookshelf, then you need to run out and get it right now.
As always, you can find all of our book recommendations on the podcast website, which is civilwarpodcast.blogspot.com. You can also find links there to our Facebook site and our Twitter feed.
And before we close, we actually wanted to give a kind of different recommendation, and this has to do with our trip to Gettysburg.
As some of y'all know, if you were on Facebook during our trip, we said that on our second day at Gettysburg, we rented bicycles and had a wonderful time using them to tour the battlefield. So we just wanted to give a shout out to Getty's Bike Tours. They're just down the hill from the visitor center. They're located in the RV and bus parking lot. You can get bicycles and have a guide take you around the battlefield that way, or you can just rent the bikes and strike off on your own, like we did. But if you're there, check them out. That's Getty's Bike Tours.
All right, and thanks for listening to this episode of The Civil War, 1861 to 1865, a history podcast. We hope you'll join us again next time as we continue with Fort Sumter, but until then, take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye. On December 26th, Anderson informed his officers that he intended to evacuate Moultrie immediately and transfer.